Chapter 12. Disturbing his slumbers, their benevolent design was disappointed, for waken him they did, and quietly slipping out of bed, he came to a place where he had a complete view of all that was going on. He did not cry out or frighten himself sillily, but, on the contrary, contented himself with watching the countenances of the robbers, so that he might recognize them on another occasion. And, though an avaricious man, he did not feel the slightest anxiety about his money chest, for the fact is, he had removed all the cash and papers the day before. As soon, however, as they had broken all the locks, and found the nothing which lay at the bottom of the chest, he shouted with such a loud voice, "Here, Thomas! John! Officer! Keep the gate, fire at the rascals!" that they, incontinently taking fright, skipped nimbly out of window, and left the house free. Carditch, after this, did not care to meet his brother-in-law, but eschewed all those occasions on which the latter was to be present at his father's house. The evening before the marriage came, and then his father insisted upon his appearance among the other relatives of the bride's and bridegroom's families, who were all to assemble and make merry. Carditch was obliged to yield, and brought with him one or two of his companions, who had been, by the way, present in the affair of the empty money boxes, and though he never fancied that there was any danger in meeting his brother-in-law, for he had no idea that he had been seen on the night of the attack, with a natural modesty, which did him really credit, he kept out of the young bridegroom's sight as much as he could, and showed no desire to be presented to him. At supper, however, as he was sneaking modestly down to a side table, his father shouted after him, "Ho, Dominic, come hither, and sit opposite to your brother-in-law," which Dominic did, his friends following. The bridegroom pledged him very gracefully in a bumper, and was in the act of making him a pretty speech, on the honor of an alliance with such a family, and on the pleasures of brother-in-lawship in general, when, looking in his face, ye gods, he saw the very man who had been filing at his money chest a few nights ago. By his side, too, sat a couple more of the gang. The poor fellow turned deadly pale and sick, and, setting his glass down, ran quickly out of the room, for he thought he was in company of a whole gang of robbers. And when he got home, he wrote a letter to the elder Carditch, humbly declining any connection with his family. Carditch the elder, of course, angrily asked the reason of such an abrupt dissolution of the engagement, and then, much to his horror, heard of his eldest son's doings. "Who would not have me marry into such a family?" said the ex-bridegroom. And old Carditch, an honest old citizen, confessed, with a heavy heart, that he would not. What was he to do with the lad? He did not like to ask for a letter to catch it, and shut him up in the bastle. He determined to give him a year's discipline at the monastery of St. Lazar. But how to catch the young gentleman? Old Carditch knew that, were he to tell his son of the scheme, the latter would never obey, and, therefore, he determined to be very cunning. He told Dominic that he was about to make a heavy bargain with the fathers, and should require a witness. So they stepped into a carriage together, and drove unsuspectingly to the Rue Saint Denis. But, when they arrived near the convent, Carditch saw several ominous figures gathering round the coach, and felt that his doom was sealed. However, he made as if he knew nothing of the conspiracy, and the carriage drew up, and his father descended, and, bidding him wait for a minute in the coach, promised to return to him. Carditch looked out. On the other side of the way, half a dozen men were posted, evidently with the intention of arresting him. Carditch now performed a great and celebrated stroke of genius, which, if he had not been professionally employed in the morning, he never could have executed. He had in his pocket a piece of linen, which he had laid hold of at the door of some shop, and from which he quickly tore three suitable stripes. One he tied round his head, after the fashion of a nightcap, a second round his waist, like an apron, and with the third he covered his hat, a round one, with a large brim. His coat and his periwig lie left behind him in the carriage, and when he stepped out from it, which he did without asking the coachman to let down the steps, he bore exactly the appearance of a cook's boy carrying a dish, and with this, he slipped through the exempts quite unsuspected, and bade adieu to the Lazarists and his honest father, who came out speedily to seek him, and was not a little annoyed to find only his coat and wig. With that coat and wig, Carditch left home, father, friends, conscience, remorse, society, behind him. He discovered, like a great number of other philosophers and poets, when they have committed rascally actions, that the world was all going wrong, and he quarreled with it outright. One of the first stories told of the illustrious Carditch, when he became professionally and openly a robber, redounds highly to his credit, and shows that he knew how to take advantage of the occasion, and how much he had improved in the course of a very few years' experience. His courage and ingenuity were vastly admired by his friends, so much so, that, one day, the captain of the band thought fit to compliment him, and vowed that when he, the captain, died, Carditch should infallibly be called to the command in chief. This conversation, so flattering to Carditch, was carried on between the two gentlemen, as they were walking one night, on the quays by the side of the Seine. Carditch, when the captain made the last remark, blushingly protested against it, and pleaded his extreme youth as a reason why his comrades could never put entire trust in him. "Sah, man," said the captain, "thy youth is in thy favor. Thou wilt live only the longer to lead thy troops to victory. As for strength, bravery, and cunning, wert thou as old as Methuselah, thou couldst not be better provided than thou art now, at 18. What was the reply of Monsieur Carditch? He answered, not by words, but by actions. Drawing his knife from his girdle, he instantly dug it into the captain's left side, as near his heart as possible, and then, seizing that imprudent commander, precipitated him violently into the waters of the Seine, to keep company with the Gugians and river gods. When he returned to the band, and recounted how the captain had basely attempted to assassinate him, and how he, on the contrary, had, by exertion of superior skill, overcome the captain, not one of the society believed a word of his history, but they elected him captain forthwith. I think His Excellency Don Rafael Morodo, the pacificator of Spain, is an amiable character, for whom history has not been written in vain. Being arrived at this exalted position, there is no end of the feats which Carditch performed, and his band reached to such a pitch of glory, that if there had been 100,000, instead of 100 of them, who knows but that a new and popular dynasty might not have been founded, and Louis Dominic, Premier Emperor de Francais, might have performed innumerable glorious actions, and fixed himself in the hearts of his people, just as other monarchs have done, 100 years after Carditch's death. A story similar to the above, and equally moral, is that of Carditch, who, in company with two other gentlemen, robbed the coach, or packet boat, from Melun, where they took a good quantity of booty, making the passengers lie down on the decks, and rifling them at leisure. His money will be but very little among three, whispered Carditch to his neighbor, as the three conquerors were making merry over their gains. If you were but to pull the trigger of your pistol in the neighborhood of your comrade's ear, perhaps it might go off, and then there would be but two of us to share. Strangely enough, as Carditch said, the pistol did go off, and number three perished. "I've him another ball," said Carditch, and another was fired into him. But no sooner had Carditch's comrade discharged both his pistols, than Carditch himself, seized with a furious indignation, drew his colon learn, "Monster," cried he, "not to be so greedy of gold, and perish, the victim of thy disloyalty and avarice." So Carditch slew the second robber, and there is no man in Europe who can say that the latter did not merit well his punishment. I could fill volumes, and not mere sheets of paper, with tales of the triumphs of Carditch and his band. how he robbed the Countess of O, going to Daijin, in her coach, and how the Countess fell in love with him, and was faithful to him ever after. How, when the lieutenant of police offered a reward of 100 pistols to any man who would bring Kardash before him, a noble marquess, in a coach and 6, drove up to the hotel of the police, and the noble marquess, desiring to see Monsieur de Lorini, on matters of the highest moment, alone, the latter introduced him into his private cabinet, and how, when there, the marquess drew from his pocket a long, curiously shaped dagger. Colon, look at this, Monsieur de Lorini, said he, this dagger is poisoned. Is it possible? Said M. de Lorini. A prick of it would do for any man, said the marquess. You don't say so, said M. de Lorini. I do, though, and, what is more, says the marquess, in a terrible voice, if you do not instantly lay yourself flat on the ground, with your face towards it, and your hands crossed over your back, or if you make the slightest noise or cry, I will stick this poison dagger between your ribs, as sure as my name is Kardash. At the sound of this dreadful name, M. de Lorini sunk incontinently down on his stomach, and submitted to be carefully gagged and corded. After which Monsieur Kardash laid his hands upon all the money which was kept in the lieutenant's cabinet. Alas! And alas! Many a stout bailiff, and many an honest fellow of a spy, went, for that day, without his pay and his victuals. There is a story, that Kardash once took the diligence to Lille, and found in it a certain Abbe Poeter, who was full of indignation against this monster of a Kardash, and said that when he went back to Paris, which he proposed to do in about a fortnight, he should give the lieutenant of police some information, which would infallibly lead to the scoundrel's capture. But poor Poeter was disappointed in his designs. For, before he could fulfill them, he was made the victim of Kardash's cruelty. A letter came to the lieutenant of police, to state that Kardash had traveled to Lille, in company with the Abbe de Poeter, of that town, that, on the reverend gentleman's return towards Paris, Kardash he had waylaid him, murdered him, taken his papers, and would come to Paris himself, bearing the name and clothes of the unfortunate Abbe, by the Lille coach, on such a day. The Lille coach arrived, was surrounded by police agents. The monster Kardash was there, sure enough, in the Abbe's guise. He was seized, bound, flung into prison, brought out to be examined, and, on examination, found to be no other than the Abbe Poeter himself. It is pleasant to read thus of the relaxations of great men, and find them condescending, to joke like the meanest of us. Another diligence adventure is recounted of the famous Kardash. It happened that he met, in the coach, a young and lovely lady, clad in widow's weeds, and bound to Paris, with a couple of servants. The poor thing was the widow of a rich old gentleman of Marseille, and was going to the capital, to arrange with her lawyers, and to settle her husband's will. The Count de Grinch, for so her fellow passenger was called, was quite as candid as the pretty widow had been, and stated that he was a captain in the regiment of Nivernois, that he was going to Paris to buy a colonelcy, which his relatives, the Duc de Bouillon, the Prince de Montmorency, the Commandeur de La Tremoille, with all their interest at court, could not fail to procure for him. To be short, in the course of the 4 days' journey, the Count Louis-Dominique de Grinch played his cards so well that the poor little widow half forgot her late husband, and her eyes glistened with tears as the Count kissed her hand at parting. At parting, he hoped, only for a few hours. Day and night the insinuating Count followed her, and when, at the end of a fortnight, and in the midst of a tete-a-tete, he plunged, one morning, suddenly on his knees, and said, Leonora, do you love me? The poor thing heaved the gentlest, tenderest, sweetest sigh in the world, and sinking her blushing head on his shoulder, whispered, Oh, Dominic, G-tame. Ah, said she, how noble is it of my Dominic, to take me with the little I have, and he so rich a nobleman. The fact is, the old baron's titles and estates had passed away to his nephews, His dowager was only left with 300,000 livres, and rent surlet a handsome sum, but nothing to compare to the rent roll of Count Dominic, Count de la Grinch, Seigneur de la Haute Pitcher, Baron de la Bigern. He had estates and wealth which might authorize him to aspire to the hand of a duchess, at least. The unfortunate widow never for a moment suspected the cruel trick that was about to be played on her, and, at the request of her affianced husband, sold out her money, and realized it in gold, to be made over to him on the day when the contract was to be signed. The day arrived, and, according to the custom in France, the relations of both parties attended. The widow's relatives, though respectable, were not of the first nobility, being chiefly persons of the finance or the robe. There was the president of the court of Arras, and his lady, a farmer general, a judge of a court of Paris, and other such grave and respectable people. As for Monsieur le Comte de la Grinch, he was not bound for names, and, having the whole peerage to choose from, brought a host of Montmorencies, Crequis, de la Tours, and Guises at his back. His homme d'affaires brought his papers in a sack, and displayed the plans of his estates, and the titles of his glorious ancestry. The widow's lawyers had her money in sacks, and between the gold on the one side, and the parchments on the other, lay the contract which was to make the widow's 300,000 francs the property of the Count de Grinch. The Count de la Grinch was just about to sign, when the Marshal de Villers, stepping up to him, said, "Captain, do you know who the president of the court of Arras, yonder, is? It is old Manasseh, the fence, of Brussels. I pawned a gold watch to him, which I stole from Cadogan, when I was with Malbrook's army in Flanders." Here the Duc de la Roche-Guyon came forward, very much alarmed. "Run me through the body," said his grace, "but the controller general's lady, there, is no other than that old hag of a Margotin who keeps the—" Here the Duc de la Roche-Guyon's voice fell. Cardich smiled graciously, and walked up to the table. He took up one of the widow's 15,000 gold pieces. It was as pretty a bit of copper as you could wish to see. "Why, dear," said he politely, "there is some mistake here, and this business had better stop." "Count," gasped the poor widow. "Count be hanged," answered the bridegroom, sternly, "why name is Cardich?" "On some French fashionable novels, with a plea for romances in general. There is an old story of a Spanish court painter, who, being pressed for money, and having received a piece of damask, which he was to wear in a state procession, pawned the damask, and appeared, at the show, dressed out in some very fine sheets of paper, which he had painted so as exactly to resemble silk. Nay, his coat looked so much richer than the doublets of all the rest, that the Emperor Charles, in whose honor the procession was given, remarked the painter, and so his deceit was found out. I have often thought that, in respect of sham and real histories, a similar fact may be noticed, the sham story appearing a great deal more agreeable, lifelike, and natural than the true one. And all who, from laziness as well as principle, are inclined to follow the easy and comfortable study of novels, may console themselves with the notion that they are studying matters quite as important as history, and that their favorite duodecimos are as instructive as the biggest quartos in the world. If then, ladies, the bigwigs begin to sneer at the course of our studies, calling our darling romances foolish, trivial, noxious to—" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.